this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Dr. Megan Osborne about the work she is doing on the genetics of desert fishes at the University of New Mexico. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Dr. Megan Osborne. Megan gained her Bachelor of Science from La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. She then went on to obtain her doctorate from La Trobe, conducting research at the Museum Victoria on the molecular evolution of possums. She then came to the United States in 2002 to conduct postdoctoral research at the University of New Mexico with Dr. Thomas Turner, where she led research projects examining the role of river fragmentation in pelagic early life history and driving genetic diversity metrics for the endangered Rio Grande silvery minnow. She is currently a research scientist at the University of New Mexico, working on a variety of genetic monitoring projects involving desert fishes of the Southwest. Welcome to the podcast, Megan.
Thanks for having me on today.
So, Megan, I am completely clueless when it comes to genetic work. How do you explain your job to your in-laws or your friends?
So, I collect genetic information from fishes, and most of this work is done non-destructively, so we don't go out there and kill a bunch of fish, because that's bad when you're working on threatened and endangered species. And then we take that genetic material, which in my case is usually a small piece of fin tissue. We take it back to the lab and then we isolate DNA from that piece of tissue. And then we can estimate genetic diversity metrics and something called the genetic effective population size from that material and then make inferences that hopefully help to direct how we might manage these species.
And so your background is kind of been more genetics first, and then now you're just working on fish, correct?
That is correct.
So your research at La Trobe involved koalas and wombats, kangaroos and possums. Are Australians as fascinated by these creatures as Americans are?
Maybe a little less so, but I think we do love our native Australian fauna because they have pouches. At least the marsupials do, and that's pretty cool.
So what kind of work were you doing with those? I mean, you mentioned you clip fins off of fish. What were you clipping off of these mammals?
Mostly we had tissue samples, but for one of the projects, we were taking hair samples from the mountain pygmy possum. So basically go and pluck a small collection of hair from the possum and then use that to isolate the DNA.
Are the Australian possums, are they a little more cute than our American Virginia possum?
They're most definitely a little more cute. I used to work on mountain pygmy possums, and these are like the cutest critter ever. They're tiny little possums, like you can fit one in the palm of your hand. They do bite, though, and that makes them a little less cute.
I was just going to say, they're from Australia. They must be able to kill you somehow, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure they could kill you, but they can certainly bite you.
So after your doctorate work, was it the opportunity to work with fish or just more genetic work that drew you to the University of New Mexico?
Well, I was kind of intrigued by working with fish. Australia faces a lot of similar issues with its rivers and native fish species as desert fishes in the American Southwest. So I thought, well, this seems like it'd be kind of applicable to Australia, so I may as well come to the United States, and I'm still here.
And with Valentine's Day right around the corner, I thought it would be nice to have a guest on talking about fish reproduction. And you recently had a paper published in Transactions of American Fisheries Society about factors affecting the reproductive success of bonytail. But before we dive into that, what is a bonytail?
So a bonytail is, its Latin name is Hela elegans, and this is a large-bodied minnow. So adults get to be pretty big, so they're not your little tiny minnow, and they're relatively long-lived, at least they were historically. They could get to be 40 years old. They historically were found in throughout the Colorado River system, but now they're considered to be functionally extirpated from the wild.
Fish spawn in a variety of different ways. How is it that these bonytail reproduce?
we didn't know a lot about how Ponytail reproduced because they were gone from the wild before anyone really had much of a chance to study them. But there were a few observations made in the wild, and this suggested that they were aggregate broadcast spawning fishes. So that means that they come together as a group of males and females. They all release their gametes into the water column where there's mixing. There's no nest building. I don't know if there's courtship behavior that hasn't been observed. And that's kind of how it goes.
All right, so they all just get together and release everything kind of untargeted and just hope it kind of mixes together.
Exactly. That's precisely how it goes. And our genetic work suggests that really is what's happening.
So then one would think that a lot of the success kind of depends on some of the environmental factors such as flow or all that. So what did your study find when it came to the environmental factors?
So let me explain a little about the study first, I think. So Ponytail is an endangered species, and one of the major threats to Ponytail are non-native predators. So there's virtually no recruitment after they reproduce into the wild population. That's why there's basically no Ponytail out there. And so for this project, equal numbers of male and female Ponytail are released into off-channel habitats, which have no predators in them, at least no aquatic predators. And in these ponds, they're allowed to reproduce naturally. So our study showed that under these conditions, virtually all adult fish contribute at least one offspring, which was fairly remarkable. And we weren't able to necessarily get at what environmental factors were driving sort of how much reproductive success there was, because in almost all cases, we had really high reproductive success. But we are now continuing this study at the Imperial National Wildlife Refuge, where we have three ponds dedicated to Ponytail reproduction and three ponds dedicated to razorback sucker reproduction. And we are, or our collaborators are collecting environmental data, so we may be able to get at what sort of environmental factors are really driving how much reproductive success there is.
So you had these fish in the ponds, and you determined that they're all, that at least one adult, or each adult was contributing at least one fish to the population. So how did you use genetics to determine all that?
So we collected genetic data from all of the adults that went into the ponds. So we have genetic information for everybody. And then throughout the reproductive season, we go out, or our collaborators go out, and they collect larvae, and then they collect recruits at the end of the year. We collect genetic information from those individuals, and then we basically use paternity testing to then assign parents to each of the progeny.
So you're essentially doing like a little 23andMe with the fish in the population to see where they came back to.
That's exactly right. We use these markers called microsatellites, which are short, tandemly repeated bits of DNA that are really variable, and then they differ a lot between individuals. The challenge with Ponytail is that all of the Ponytail pretty much out there in existence are derived from fewer than 10 individuals. So Ponytail as a whole doesn't have a whole lot of genetic diversity. So we use a relatively large panel of microsatellite markers to be able to conduct parentage analysis.
So is there any hope for the Ponytail in the future?
I try not to be too pessimistic, but I like to think that there is, but it's going to take a lot of effort to be able to establish a riverine population of Ponytail, because the non-native predators are not going anywhere anytime soon. And Ponytail is a little different from razorback sucker in that they can never get big enough to evade predation by things like bass. For razorback sucker, they can grow them up in a hatchery or in a protected habitat to a size where they can evade predation. So there's a little more hope for razorback.
I was just about to ask, is the predation from natural predators or non-natives? And I guess you kind of answer it is non-natives. So.
Non-natives. There is a lot of a reasonable amount of bird predation by things like cormorants and great blue herons and stuff like that. They have a kind of a taste for Ponytail, evidently.
So you mentioned the razorback sucker there, and you have a few other projects going on looking at some other desert fishes, and you're still kind of working on the Rio Grande silvery minnow. Would you mind telling us a little bit about some of those other projects you have going on?
One of the main projects that I work on is on Rio Grande silvery minnow, and this is an endangered small-bodied cyprinid that historically was found throughout the Rio Grande and the Pecos River in New Mexico and Texas. It now, the population is now confined to the middle Rio Grande in New Mexico. It's been completely extirpated from the Pecos River. There's also a small reintroduced non-essential experimental population in the Big Bend region of Texas. Silvery minnow is a really short-lived species, so the majority of individuals live only about a year, and spawning in this species occurs over a really brief period of time, and it's typically associated with snowmelt runoff and rainstorm events that occur in the spring. So because of some of these characteristics, when we don't have snowpack and our rivers dry in the southwest, particularly the Rio Grande, we can have really extreme interannual fluctuations in population size, and this can adversely affect how much genetic diversity is in the population. So for silvery minnow, augmentation with captive bred or reared fish is sort of a cornerstone of the recovery efforts for this species. So the genetic work that we do, we go out and we collect genetic information from both fish collected from the wild as well as all of the stocks of fish that are released to the river, and to look to see how genetic diversity changes over time. Because if a population has really low genetic diversity, that can lead to things like inbreeding effects and an inability of the population to respond to future climatic changes and things like that.
So you're also doing some work on the Canadian River with some peppered chubs in the Arkansas River Shiner. Are these fish kind of facing some of the same issues as the bony tails and the silvery minnows?
Yes, that's true. So the Arkansas River Shiner, so this is also a pelagic spawning minnow like Rio Grande silvery minnow, and it's threatened by a lot of the same issues as silvery minnow. It's relatively short-lived. It has a fairly restricted range and inhabits rivers which have dams. They grow dry, and these things don't work well for fish. The peppered chub is actually not federally listed as an endangered or threatened species. However, it is really imperiled. It has a very restricted range. It's now only found in a portion of the Canadian River in New Mexico and in Oklahoma. It was, until relatively recently, also found in some Arkansas River drainages, but it's been extirpated from those systems. So now there's basically one population left. So the genetic work that we're doing on these populations is to track genetic change over time to see if these periods of really low density adversely impact the species. In addition to this, if conservation efforts were to go towards establishing, say, a captive breeding program for Arkansas River Shiner or peppered chub, it's really important to have some baseline genetic information so that you can set up a captive breeding program that accurately reflects the genetic legacy of these two species.
You work on a variety of fishes in the desert southwest, the bony tail, the razorback sucker, silvery minnow, the peppered chub, kind of all these fish that are small or in these areas where most people don't see. How do you get your work out, or what differences have you observed between working with these desert fishes and more charismatic creatures like kangaroos and wombats and koalas? What differences have you observed trying to get your work out or tell people about your work?
I think people are a little less excited about fish because they don't see them. I work on, Rio Grande silvery minnow, which is found in the Rio Grande, which is just right. It flows through Albuquerque, and most people don't really know that there's fish in that river. I mean, we'll be out there in the field sampling, and people are like, well, what are you looking for? And you show them, we collect fish and show them to them, and then they're really excited about it. But I think it is definitely harder to get people excited about, fish, even in their own backyard. I think they'd be more excited about possums, but maybe that's just the Australian talking in me.
They might be more excited about fish than our Virginia possums here.
Well, there you go.
And we have that going for us.
Yep.
Well, Megan, now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Well, I'm going to put it out there, the salamander fish. So this is a freshwater fish that's only found in southwestern Australia, and it lives in ephemeral pools. And when the pools dry out, it burrows in the mud at the bottom, and then it emerges when it starts to rain again. And I think if our fishers in the American Southwest could learn a few things from the salamander fish, things might be looking up for them.
I'll have to say that is the first time anyone has said salamander fish.
Well, that's good.
And Megan, what is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
I would say attending a Desert Fishers Council meeting in Cuatro Cienega not too long after I came to the United States. I don't know if you're familiar with Cuatro Cienega, but it's in Coahuila in Mexico, and it's a series of freshwater springs that are home to this really unique fauna and flora. Has three endemic turtles and eight species of endemic fish and a number of endemic snails. And we had the opportunity to go out there and swim with the fish and see a very unique part of the world.
You're two for two on giving very unique answers to these so far. All right. And what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
Well, I'd like to go back to Australia at some point, probably Tasmania. That's the island that's off the southern tip of Australia. I guess I'd like to do something that involves conservation of fishes, or maybe even get back to my roots and work on marsupials again.
Now, this isn't one of the final five questions, but I meant to ask, now that you've worked with fish, are you stuck with fish forever? You mentioned you want to go back with marsupials.
I could work on anything. You know, I just had a paper accepted on salamanders. I've worked on frogs, fish, marsupials. I think everything has its cool aspects, so I'm not stuck on fish.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Okay, if money and politics weren't an issue, I'd like to be involved with projects that address some of the core reasons for the declines of species, rather than just working on species where chances of recovery really depend on us getting, you know, dealing with some of these main reasons for decline.
Finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Fish matter, so do rivers, and we should endeavor to minimize our impacts and step up our efforts to restore them.
Megan, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and the work you're doing out there in the desert. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
You can look me up on the University of New Mexico Department of Biology website or ResearchGate. I'm out there.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, at Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Our guest for next week is a fellow colleague of mine in Kansas, Ben Neely. You can download and subscribe to that episode and others on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 25th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, fish matter, and so do rivers.